Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Joining me on this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I have Matthew Smitley. Matthew is an assistant professor in the University of Kentucky's Professional Masters of Athletic Training program. With over a decade of experience as an athletic trainer, he focuses on bringing clinical practice with research to improve patient care. His research interests include novel manual therapies, professional recruitment and retention, and research literacy. As the incoming chair of the National Athletic Trainers Association Career Advancement Committee, he serves on the CAC to address issues related to career growth, work-life balance, and retention issues for athletic trainers in their 7th to 12th year of certification. Outside of work, he enjoys spending time with his family, singing, and following college football. Now on to the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. This week, I have Matt Smitley, who's an athletic trainer and also is the assistant professor at the University of Kentucky in the athletic training program. Thought that he would be a great person to have on the show to talk about the future of athletic training and where it's going. So we're going to look at the relevance of athletic training. We're going to discuss job vacancies, and then we're going to get into there's a case for dual credentialing. If that makes a difference in our profession, should we look at that? NATA advocacy and member support, and then doctorate of AT programs. And if that's something that is up for debate, I think there's still some debate whether or not AT should be looking towards that as an advanced degree or not, depending on what their goals are. And then, you know, his fulfillment at UK, and then also where he sees his program heading in the future. So, Matt, I appreciate your coming on a Saturday. I know you probably have really busy weeks and semesters, so I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, I'm excited to join in, and I'm glad that we were able to get this to work out.
Now, can you tell the viewers, listeners, a little bit about you, how you end up getting to UK, a little background about you as a professional in the athletic training profession?
Yeah, so my background is in the profession actually started in high school. I had a sports med class that I was able to take a part in. Admittedly, it was so I could have an extra free period where I didn't have class that was designed for internships, but we were able to work it around to where I could have some time off. But by accident, by taking this course, I found a curriculum and a content that I truly enjoyed. It came kind of what felt naturally to me, and it opened up into a pretty awesome profession and career. So after experimenting with that class, I went through undergrad. So I got my associate's degree at Allen Hancock College in Santa Maria, California, transferred to California Baptist University and got my bachelor's in kinesiology there, and then stayed there at Cal Baptist to get my master's of science in AT. Immediately after that, I went out to practice as a high school athletic trainer in Western North Carolina. And even on top of that, I was able to get some experiences with other types of work within the profession, kind of varied settings. But my primary duty was outreach full time to a mid-sized high school there in Western North Carolina. And then after about 3 years, I kind of realized that there was a sense of me, for lack of a better term, like wanting to do better. I felt that my patient outcomes could be better. My professors at Cal Baptist kind of had they'd given me access to some material or demonstrated some techniques that made me think patient care could be more efficient, more effective. And so I followed a couple of them to the University of Idaho. I got my doctorate in athletic training there. And then kind of right place, right time, faculty position opened up, and I was able to get that position there at the University of Idaho. And then quickly transitioned into the program director role at the University of Idaho for the master's program. And then at the end of my time there, I was director of both the MSAT and the DAT programs. This past year, I kind of made some intentional decisions for my family life and with my wife and son. But, you know, we wanted to prioritize this phase of life to you know, focus more on family. So that led to us looking at other positions. And the University of Kentucky had a position that was open. And very long story short, we felt very confident that this was the right move. So we transitioned into this role and wrapping up, or feels weird to say I'm wrapping up my first academic year here at UK, but it's been an exciting year so far.
That's great. I think that's a pretty good description of kind of the timeline of where you've gone as high school, eager high school student looking into sports medicine and where you've ended up. And it's interesting to talk to guests about their track of their professional careers and where they're going, where they think they're, where they've been and where they think they might land. Because I think our profession is one of those professions that we have a lot of autonomy, but we also have a lot of directions we can go. I mean, the sky's kind of the limit. It's what you make for yourself, and it's also what's available and what you want to take chances on. So it sounds like you made those correct choices, and it landed you in a place where it seems like you're happy right now.
Yeah. We've been very fortunate and blessed every juncture. My wife kind of by happenstance as an athletic trainer. That was not by design in our relationship, but we, when we met, she was already kind of well into the profession herself. And we've both been very fortunate to have had a lot of support and a lot of awesome opportunities open up. And, a lot of it's the diligent work of those that have invested in us that have allowed us to get to these types of positions. So it's pretty cool to be in this phase of life in our careers.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I when I got out of school, I got out a long time ago. So Professor Chad Starkey was my clinical director at Northeastern University, our program director. And then so he and I had him on a few episodes ago. And we were talking about like where people, there's not a lot of people that are career will stay in one position for their entire career. And like I said to him, I said, I feel like I'm one of those dinosaurs. I end up getting a job out of college through someone I knew by chance.
Yeah,
and I stayed in that position, and 29 years later, I'm still in that position. And I'm a clinical director for a PT practice in the local area, and then I'm also an athletic trainer for the local high school where I've been for almost the same amount of time. So for me, I felt like I embedded myself in a community and try to grow as a professional and the practice, but also people understand what they're getting when they come to see me. So I think for me, that was my kind of calling. I still have clinical students that I mentor and teach, which is great. So that's my academic side of me, which is good. So it does take different shapes for different people.
It does. And I think it speaks to, it's a very unique pathway to be able to land somewhere and that be kind of, the proverbial home run for that to be able to stay and invest and develop roots in a community and with an employer and those types of things. I think nowadays that's a rarity. And I don't say that in a negative light as much as it is that it just shines a light on how awesome that opportunity must have been to start. And there's things that have just evolved, whether it's your life or professionally, that have supported that, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And I talk to young professionals about this all the time. And we just say, that the conversation revolves around what do you want? Like, what do you think you want? And how can we help get you there? And what's the opportunity for you that presents itself? And I think if they have a good roadmap, it's hard to ask those kids that come right out of school. But if they want to aspire to be a professional athlete trainer in a professional level athlete training position or work in a college or in a high school or even, clinical outreach, I think for them, it's like, okay, let's try to map this out so you're successful.
Yeah.
Right. Let's not have you fail. Let's have you become good at what you want to do. And let's do that. And I think that's absolutely what we need to do with each other is try to continue to build that camaraderie in our profession to kind of make sure the profession stays alive, which is one of the things we'll get to today is like, where are we going? So if you look at the relevance of athlete training, like the future of it, we've seen a change. I mean, since I've been out, it's changed 25 times. I mean, I just feel like it's always evolving and changing. To get better, you need to evolve, you need to innovate, you need to be able to look forward and not be stuck on the things that you're doing now, because if you do, you're going to be irrelevant. So I think for us, like, how do we get better and what's the future of it? What do you see as, in the academic realm of where athlete training is going? I know we're going to talk about DAT programs, but right now, what are you seeing with the students and the academics on the side of the program?
Yeah, on the academic end, I think that we're seeing kind of a shift in partly in our student population, namely that, now that we have our entry level degree at the master's level, that opens up a lot of doors and opportunities for non-traditional entries into the profession. So, you know, historically, when we have the bachelor's degree program, you know, you declare your major, I'll say early on in your collegiate career, and then you stick to that. And then sometimes it seems a little counterintuitive to go back into a bachelor's. It's not uncommon, but just is not the norm. And then now with our master's students, we're seeing a lot of students that are getting complementary degrees. So they don't necessarily have to have a degree, a bachelor's degree in kinesiology. Programs that I've been affiliated with in the past have accepted students with an English degree or with an engineering background or whatever that might look like, provided that the prerequisites are there. And so I think the master's degree has granted the opportunity for people to come back into AT as a second profession or as a non-traditional student, or, you know, that we have more. I've seen more parents come through AT programs, which may not be as feasible in other pathways. So I think, you know, that's one thing that's really critically changing. And I think the other part too that students are seeing beyond tuition, and that is a whole discussion there.
Exactly.
And the inflation of collegiate education, period. But when they're saying, I'm going to financially and literally and figuratively invest in my education, I now need to get the best experience. And so students, I don't think, are as concerned with the prestige of a name of an institution. They want to know, what is the quality of the experience that I'm going to get there? And specific to AT, I think kind of the make or break that I've seen with a lot of students is the clinical education portion. You know, the KD has allowed and granted the opportunity for there to be a lot of flexibility in how we implement the immersive clinical education model. And so with that, students are wanting to get a richer and fuller experience that may not necessarily be with that institution. And so that, I think, is forcing programs to be a little bit more responsive in the short term to what students desire. But then also it increases the burden on the program to make sure they are getting a quality experience. I, as a program, could send my students to anywhere in the world, provided they have a qualified preceptor there. But I can't promise that it's going to be a good clinical experience until I've established a good rapport and probably sent a couple of students there. And so that's kind of the increase on the other end, is it's forcing us to vet preceptors in the clinical education. So that's where I think kind of we're seeing this continual transition heading, is an increased importance on, one, I think we've got to do our best to mitigate costs. You know, with students that are leaving their bachelor's degree with, you know, $30,000 in debt on average. And then now we need to make sure that we're giving them a degree in experience that is worth, you know, the additional investment.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and I've talked to several professionals or colleagues about this, about return on investment. And we talk about the ever-changing, elevated costs of education. And my wife and I, we have one daughter who's finishing graduate school this May. So for her, she's already gone through undergrad. She's going through grad school. The expense is astronomical. I mean, it's weird. When I went to school, I'm like, this is completely ridiculous. But anyway, I think the main thing that I got from one of my colleagues, who's actually was the director of the athletic training program at LaSalle University in Boston, she's now in the more of the future development of the university. So she's moved into a different position. She talked about how you have to look at this, and she was talking about her husband going to law school, like, and the cost of law school. And but she said, you know, the one thing that we talked about, and I talk about with this with students all the time, it's not that you're investing for 1 year, you're investing for the rest of your life. So you have to look at that broken down into years of service. So if it costs you $40,000 or $50,000 and you accumulate that debt, or, I mean, look at PT, that's could be $300,000 in debt. But you have to look at that like over the trajectory of your career and say, hey, is this worth it? And what's my return on investment? So I think that's a better conversation for kids to understand, or young adults to understand, is that you're investing in your future and your ability to become profitable as a person or as a provider. So I think that's important. On the side of the preceptors, yeah, I think you need to definitely have a good understanding of who you're sending kids to, because if they don't have a good experience, that's going to sour them on the profession for the rest of their life. And I think that's the important piece. And that's hard for you to do as an educator, because you can't be to all these locations and visit. You know, if locally you could see probably 10 or 15 a year you can go visit, or maybe a little more, but even then that becomes difficult. So how do we change that? How do we make that better for the athletic training students to get a better experience?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different perspectives, and my students would probably roll their eyes if they hear me say the phrase, it depends. But that's my answer to a lot of their questions. And then I'll clarify, but I typically would say it depends, and I'll try my best to limit that today. But I think to make it, you know, I think from a holistic perspective, I think it would be important for us to address professionally concerns that exist for ATs and preceptors alike, you know, where I pulled my students on, you know, unofficially, it was not a scientific poll, but I, you know, had to say by show of hands, how many of you in the classroom have had a preceptor, current or prior to your time in the program, so maybe as someone you observed, to say to not get into the profession? Mm-hmm. And it was about 70% of them.
Wow.
Which is really concerning.
It is.
And there's likely reasons, very valid reasons for that kind of distaste. But I think we've got to continue to work towards addressing what those concerns are.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think kind of on the other end of that, I think we've got to support students getting quality experiences and challenging maybe what we're used to as preceptors and ATs. Like what did my preceptors, or, you know, the old phrase used to be the ACIs, approved clinical instructors, right? Like what did they do? And so the danger that I've, you know, had to communicate with students is you can go to this very prominent athletic group, I'll summarize it vaguely like that, but I can't promise that you're going to get a lot of hands-on experience.
Mm-hmm.
With understandable reasons to some extent, you know, is this prominent Power 5 or Power 4 program going to allow you to do direct patient care on their starting quarterback?
Right.
Well, even probably before not. NIL, that's a interesting, you know, investment that we would be toying with. But on the other side of that, our students need that experience, though. I mean, so how can we balance in getting our students meaningful patient care hours,
mm-hmm.
while also not just sitting and holding a rack of water bottles and folding towels?
Right, right.
Full disclosure, when I work clinically, I'm not above holding water bottles and filling up a cooler. And those things are part of AT practice, but I want to make sure that my students are getting an actual quality experience of, let's talk through our patient care decision-making. Let's see that you can apply these things in real time or critically think on the fly. And that's my students that, you know, historically that have had awesome clinical rotations have been those preceptors that have intentionally pushed that on their students.
Yeah. And I like the water bottle and towel comment. I will get back to that because that's going to bring me to the salary piece that we'll talk about, because I think there's something there when you're on national TV and that's what you're running across the field with. So we'll talk about that. We'll get into that. You know, when we look at like job influx and vacancies, you see a ton. I get a ton of job postings.
Yeah,
I get stuff every day. You know, you're qualified for this. You're qualified for this. You're a top candidate for this. I think I can't remember the true stat, but I want to say there was like, you know, a few thousand jobs that were open, and, you know, the amount of schools that have the opportunity to hire an athletic trainer. And, you know, in the state of Massachusetts alone, I think we have, I want to say the amount of high schools is 800 and some odd high schools in the state of Massachusetts. Now, you know, there's definitely opportunity there, right? So how do we make that opportunity more available? And what do you think the catalyst is? Do you think it's like, there's definitely salaries involved here with this. I think it's what people feel like they're, or professionals feel like they deserve for their salary. How do you bump that salary? Where do you get into, can you get into a teacher's union as part of it, or be a faculty member at a university or even a high school level? What have you been seeing or hearing on your side as to why we're seeing this? And do you feel like we're going to come out of the woods anytime soon with, you know, filling these and having better chances of better positioning for athletic trainers?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for the vacancies. I would say anecdotally, I think from my perspective, the bulk of the reason is that there are ATs leaving those settings for others, or mm-hmm. others is a very broad and vague category, right? But they're leaving for something else. I think that there's also some of that can be accounted to employers, institutions, whatever, seeing value in hiring ATs. We've had some very unfortunate things happen. In the limelight, you know, thinking of, you know, what happened with Damar Hamlin a couple of years ago, where I think that thrust, you know, this type of healthcare profession into the limelight. And I'm not saying that's the single catalyst for, you know, additional vacancies and creating positions, but I think it has become a conversation piece. But I would say a lot of it is, you know, there's vacancies because ATs are leaving to go to somewhere where they feel more supported, whether it's in their professional life or in their personal life or both. And so I think, you know, to say it's salary and compensation and work-life balance and low administrative support, like it's yes to all those things. But I think many ATs are continuing to speak and say, I'm going to go where I'm valued and they support the things that I value. So we I'm on the career athletic, or sorry, the career advancement committee for the NATA, in that our focus is primarily geared towards ATs in years 7 through 12 of their time in clinical practice. Mm-hmm. And that is a crucial time when we see people changing professions, changing positions, leaving professions, you name it. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But we've done one article, we've written one or conducted some research and did a survey of over 1,100 ATs a few years ago. And it was primarily focused at post-COVID impacts. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the things that they were saying were, you know, administrators don't understand what we do. We don't feel respected as a profession or as a professional. You know, I think that there's some low backing or administrative support for ATs. And then also they desire some transparency and communication. And so one article that we're working on currently, we're in the very last phases, so it's under review actually, is, you know, we qualitatively interviewed a lot of people, a lot of ATs that have either considered or have left the collegiate setting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, I'm going to summarize, pointed to say that, yes, salary would be an excellent starting point. And that was very clearly there. But on the other end of it, they had noted all of these non-financial things that said if this were better, changing this one aspect would probably radically change how I view leaving this setting, leaving this institution, or leaving the profession as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so it pointed to that, like, yes, the financial and the compensation, so the non-financial compensation, but we're looking at benefits packages as a whole, those are critical. But I think the other part, too, is people are going to go where they're valued. You know, literature pointing at trends with millennials and Gen Z, you know, that's the majority of our workforce now. Mm-hmm. And I think that somewhere up to 20% of millennials have changed their job within the last year.
Yeah.
And for both, they value working somewhere where they feel supported professionally, but also they feel supported in their personal lives. So can we grant additional aspects to work-life balance that maybe would support the whole person rather than just the worker? And so that's where I think there's a lot of vacancies, is that we're seeing a lot of these things kind of come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. I spoke to an athletic trainer who's at Southern Oregon University a few weeks back, and we talked about, you know, what are we running into here? What's the catalyst? What's the roadblock here?
Yeah.
And I think the biggest thing that we both came up with was that athletic training, if you think about it, you're almost looked at as a liability, right? Because how are you generating revenue? So I think a revenue discussion is there too. Like, how do we generate revenue for who we're working for? And I think there was the other piece of the conversation branched out into, well, if you have one ACL reconstruction that you're rehabilitating, that's probably a $60,000 positive for the university, right? So you have to go in and have the right conversations with your administrators to provide the right information. And that's where documentation comes in. If you're not being good with how you document and how you show your value, then you're not going to get anywhere. And that's any organization. I mean, we deal with it in the PT world, where with physical therapy, you're providing value, you're seeing patients, you're billing out for service, you're getting reimbursed. But there's also a foundation of what you should be seeing day over day to make sure you're being profitable for that organization, but also getting great outcomes, right? So if you're not drawing outcomes in athletic training, you can't show what you're doing. So I think that should be the discussion. I feel like there's a lot of athletic trainers that feel like because they have experience, they walk into a position and I deserve X, but they're like, well, show us why.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty simple to do, right? You could take and say, I was at this last position. These are the amount of injuries I saw per year, the amount of treatments I did per year. These are my outcomes. And this is what I potentially could have saved this community.
Yep.
And that's a great talking point, right? Because then you're giving them information on what we do. And that's the growing awareness piece.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the water bottle and towel discussion. When you watch a professional sporting event, no matter what it is, mostly if you're dealing with, you know, hockey, you see them on the, you know, they're standing there with a towel. They don't touch the water bottles, but they're standing there. you'll see some emergency care on the ice. When you're watching football, you see them go out for maybe one or two situations on the field, but mostly timeouts. And then for baseball, you don't see anybody run out onto the field. In basketball, you might see a few. So
right.
What do we do outside of watching a game?
Yeah.
Where there is an emergency provider on the field of contest, but open up and show what we're doing for the 3 or 4 hours prior and the 2 or 3 hours after,
absolutely.
Right? Leads up. So I think that's an important piece we need to expand.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we, all of this circles around the phrase value. So worth and value have carry similar connotations, but when we look at worth from a business perspective, that means I have a specific dollar amount that's tied to the service that I provide. And then value can be up to the beholder, what they perceive as important or what they see as the overall worth or benefit from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my mentors, he always challenged us as students to think, how am I communicating this in a meaningful way? So if I am, let's look at ankle patient care, ankle rehab, you know, I can tape 300 ankles in a day. And for someone that might get their wheel saying, oh, they're doing a lot. We need to, you know, compensate them because they're doing so much work. Then I could, on the other end, say, you know, published literature says it takes weeks to months to get a patient fully pain-free, fully functional, and feeling like they are normally participating in their daily life. What if I can accelerate that timeline down to a couple days or to a week? That then shifts the value of what I provide in a much different light. And so I think one of the biggest lessons I learned in my first few years of clinical practice is I have to approach every conversation pursuing the love language that makes sense for that other person. So an example of this is that I needed equipment in my AT clinic. And I went to the administrator at my institution. I said, hey, I need this. And he saw the dollar amount and said, I can't do that. Absolutely not. And then I you know, in further conversations, I expressed why this was important. And it became very apparent to me that, oh, this administrator is very concerned about liability, lawsuits, litigation, that type of thing. And so I learned that if there was a critical need that I had to get fulfilled, I had to frame it in that light, not in a way to be manipulative, but to make sure he heard what was important from what he was concerned about. And that love language is going to change by the person you talk to. So mom and dad, or if I'm speaking in front of a large group of athletes or parents or administrators, their interest in what I do is going to vary based off of what they see my role or that they know my role to be. So I need to be better at telling the story that I have. And that's, I think, my nerdy side with data is that data can tell a story depending on how we view it. And so we need to make sure that we're being very intentional about how we're telling our story.
Right. Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, we had the same situation. I was trying to lobby to get a cold plunge for recovery. And my AD saw the price tag and I had to lay out the reasons why. I said, you know, we're dealing with a lot of running athletes, a lot of athletes that are endurance athletes. The cold plunge would be great for recovery. And so we laid out the research and the data and then gave them all the information. They actually purchased it for us. So we went the whole winter season and the kids were using it all the time for recovery post-race.
Mm-hmm.
And the coach, they end up winning a state championship. And the coach is like, I attribute that to what we're doing for post-recovery. So they're,
yeah,
the proof's in the pudding.
Yeah.
And they did a lot of other things for recovery, but that was certainly, even the athletes were like, they felt the best they have felt because they had the ability to recover a little bit better using different types of therapies to help them get there.
Yeah.
So again, that's something that, you know, going back to research, you're providing data. Like you said, data tells a story. My second master's was in analytics and sports science. So I like to show the numbers and the data,
yeah,
too. And,
yep,
you know, Tableau's my friend. I like to show, yep, like stuff to everybody and you nerd out on it.
Right.
But I think that's a good thing to have available to you. And that's the other thing is like, how can you bring more value? Or like you said, you know, what can you bring to the table? Basically, what are you adding to show that you're going to care for the athlete? And you said, you know, previously about ankle sprains, you know, it could take several months for someone to feel fully functional. And we have these conversations with clinical staff a bunch about, you know, properly dosing treatments. Like when you see somebody, you know that you can get them better the more you see them and shorten the duration of the treatment. So meaning if you see them once a week for 12 weeks, they're never going to get better. If you see them twice a week for 6 weeks, they're going to get better and they'll probably be on a good trajectory. If you saw them 3 to 4 to 5 days a week, like a regular athlete you were seeing in the athlete training room, they're going to get better a lot faster because you have eyes on them every day. And to get them to understand that is very difficult. And I don't know what the roadblock is there. I don't know if it's just the mental piece, but it does. When you're dealing with private practice, it's dealing with, you know, financial obligations for patients and things of that nature. Yeah. If you can get them to understand that, and it's the same in the athlete training world, you know, more is better with athletes. The more you can see them and keep an eye on them, the better they're going to get when it comes to rehabilitation. So if you can provide that literature, that's going to be huge for you for negotiation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, where the burden then shifts back to, you know, the professional, whoever it is. So if we're talking, you know, job negotiation, you know, what is the key pain point for the person that I'm meeting with? Or who is it that makes the decision? So I've learned in the last couple of years that, you know, we're pretty frustrated with salaries and compensation. So we're, you know, chirping at, you know, athletic directors, and we're responding to things on social media, blasting ATs that are just posting a vacancy that are at their job. They have no control over what the salary is set at.
Right. Right.
And it becomes a much bigger discussion where you've got to start talking to HR departments and maybe educating them. Or when it comes to a patient care piece of, well, let's look at my patient care outcomes compared to the literature. Or if I don't have that, what is the literature saying? How can we maximize this? And so then it requires that we become good consumers and utilizers of the research. And so this is really big cyclical, or maybe this just like there's a lot of overlap on the Venn diagram of what our responsibilities are. And, you know, you look at a you know, overworked and underpaid AT, they don't have the bandwidth to do all that, a lot of that. And so maybe it's easier to shift and let me just go to this other place that's going to value me differently.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And everybody wants to have a little bit of recognition, you know, that makes them feel better.
Yeah.
You have to have that with your peers, your colleagues, just to let them know that, hey, you're doing a great job. Because I think a lot of people hear more negative connotations towards them, where that could be a problem, where that degrading them in their profession to the point where they're just like, I'm not really comfortable here. I'm going to move on. Where you should be, you know, giving them more praise on what they're doing and how they're doing it on a daily basis, or even a weekly basis on, for that matter.
Yeah. And I think that points out a big picture that, you know, I kind of have been thinking on professionally is, you know, as professionals, we want recognition. And I think it's very common for administrators to say, we value ATs, we value sports medicine, we value what they bring to the table. And I think that there's truth in what they're saying. But when it's not demonstrated, then it feels inauthentic. So I've described authenticity to my students as alignment between what we think and feel, and then also how we're acting. And so and we're following through on both parts. And then that's when we have authenticity in ourselves, in our communication, and how we connect with others. And so when we're only getting one half of that equation, some ATs and professionals are only getting no halves. They're just existing and nobody talks to them.
Right, right.
And so I think there's a desire for authenticity. We want to see how people feel about us and know that we're valued, and then also see an act that, you know, supports that.
Yeah. Now, I think as far as our profession goes, I mean, I think there's a case for dual credentialing, I think, in some instances. And there are a lot of programs that I think are still out there with it. Is this something that we should be thinking of as ATs? I think because, you know, I'm thinking increasing marketability, you know, profession might be, you know, better benefits for dual credentialing, additional certifications in the field relations and physical therapy, nutrition, strength, conditioning, sports science.
Yeah.
Where do you think we fall there? Do you think we're just opening ourselves up and succumbing to the inevitable that AT by itself is going to go by the wayside? Or do you feel like where are we in this kind of transition? Because it does seem like, and it's going to lead up to our next conversation piece on advocacy from the NATA. So I think, where are we in that?
Yeah. So I think that as far as dual credentialing goes, my answer would be it depends. And I think that's a kind of an individual conversation. You know, I get pretty leery of recommending a pathway for an entire profession or a large subset of people. You know, I would look at dual credentialing very similar to how I look at pursuing continuing education. My concern or fear is that professionals, not just AT, healthcare professionals as a whole, pursue training in a way to get alphabet soup behind their names.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think you can have every possible tool in your toolbox, but if you are not practiced and well-trained and can critically think of when and why and how and maybe when not to use those tools, you're just like every other novice, you know, carpenter out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, whether it comes to a dual credentialing, when we look at AT or PT, or if we're looking at AT and maybe something in the realm of sports science or strength conditioning, I think those are all excellent pathways. I have worked alongside some awesome dual credentialed people in my past, but I think it's good to use that when it's appropriate or when the need is there.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than saying, you know, maybe we kind of tie ourselves to the hip of this other degree or this other profession, maybe we have ATs that are participating in that space so that they can kind of be this liaison knowledge-wise
mm-hmm.
between both. And then I think that that's when we have a little bit more intentional and purposeful use of those things. But I get scared when students say, well, I want to get another degree after my master's in athletic training. And I will never turn someone away from that. But my first question is, objectively or out of my own ignorance, why?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if they can communicate the value of to that, then I may say, hey, that I think sounds really good. Or, hey, maybe you pause and look at the investment financially or otherwise that this is going to take and the return on that investment.
The only reason I ask that is because when you look at a lot of collegiate professional positions that are available now or open, it'll say athletic training and PT preferred, right? So you'll see a lot of those professional jobs. And I have many friends and colleagues that work in professional sports. And I'll call them on some jobs. So I got people that might be looking. I'm like, hey, there's a position here posted. What if they apply if they're just an AT?
Yeah.
And most of the time it's, well, yeah, they'll look at their resume, but they want to make sure they have more so they can do more with the athletes. And that's the reason why I ask that. Because if somebody aspires to go in the professional realm of sports, what is our conversation with them? I think that's, we don't want to discourage people from not being athletic trainers. Because I think the profession is a fantastic profession. That's why I got into it.
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm still in it.
Yep.
But I think there's got to be an understanding. And again, I think there's the education piece that you and I talked about previously is, you know, educating people why. And I think, you know, when you look at big organizations, they know what we do because they're investing in their athletes by giving them the best medical care possible. And so I think it's a challenge for young adults coming out. Unless they get an internship in a professional level, it can be quite daunting, I think. I remember coming out of undergrad and you mentioned being a novice carpenter, right? Dr. Starkey said to us, he said, you know, don't forget, because you pass your certification exam, that's just entry level for you. Doesn't mean that you know anything. You passed a written simulation and a practical. We had all three.
Yeah.
He's like, you're able to start to practice.
Yeah.
So make sure that you increase your ability to learn and expand your knowledge base to get better and learn how to fail. Because I think that's the one thing that young adults are really afraid of is failing, right? They don't understand what failure means. I had this great conversation with our daughter about a month ago. And she was upset about something that, you know, one of her exams she didn't do great on. And I said, listen, you have to understand, nobody is perfect. I said, physicians I work with, surgeons, PTs, ATs, we are not perfect. I fail more often than you think, but that's how we learn. That's how we get better, right? So how do you kind of pull all that together? And I think this goes to that kind of that discussion of the whole advocacy piece. Like, how do we get better at advocating and get member support, right? How does that happen through our national organization, but also our state and local organizations on how to be able to do that with our young professionals?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it, you know, the NATA is definitely responding to this because I think the needs of ATs are so varied in navigating this space, whether it's job negotiation or expressing the value of what ATs do, or, you know, and unfortunately, a group like the NATA can't be present for however, we've got, what, 40,000 members roughly in the NATA. They can't be present for all of those conversations.
Right. All those negotiations.
Right. And so that then swings to the importance of the structure of the NATA and then even smaller organizations like districts and states. And there, we're starting to even see some growth in groups that are more specialty focused. So athletic training in physician practice has a society. I think that there's an industrial athletic trainer society out there. And so that's where I think, you know, we're having to share this burden across the board. And that's where I think the value comes from. But then the other challenge is, you know, the NATA recognizes something and then another group does. And so we have, you know, two, three or more organizations working parallel, but not talking to one another mm-hmm. on how we're addressing these issues.
Yeah.
And so it just becomes this really kind of mixed bag, you know, when it comes to solving these issues. But I think that's it's critical that we are saying, well, what can I realistically expect of the organization that I'm a part of? And then how can I contribute to that? So if there's not a solution, maybe I need to help create the solution because there just may not be awareness of it as well.
Yeah. And I think the NATA is doing a good job. I know they're revamping the executive leadership there, have done that. I think it's trickling down, like you had mentioned, like the societies and organizations below. Because I think if, depending on where you work, you have to understand what your state regulations are in legislature to understand what you can actually provide under your practice act to be able to right. then go and negotiate. So you can't yeah. just think of going to a state and saying, I deserve this, right? Because you could have a different regulation or legislation that you can actually practice under. If there's licensure in the state, I think now there's every state except maybe one or two. I could be off on that, but I think you need to understand the law of the state to be able to negotiate appropriately, I think. And I think that comes down to you being more involved in your state and local organizations for that to happen. Learning a little bit about government maybe might be helpful for them. And I think there's some older guys like us, or like me, I should say, that we're kind of like, I don't know, on the tail end of your career. So you're really happy what you're doing. You like doing it. You're thinking of next steps. Like, am I going to completely leave the profession? Am I going to have some involvement? Am I going to teach? Yeah. Am I going to... So I think there's, you know, to have that support within the organization and someone to go to would be is fantastic, but I think you got to lean on your local and state a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I've seen anecdotally is that, you know, our regional and local and even our regional, state and more local organizations are desperate for feet and hands to help commit to that work. And the downside is it is work. On top of, you know, the volunteerism has a piece that requires effort and work from me. And that's very challenging as a professional when I'm currently in, I'm helping teach or co-teach across five courses. I've got a 2-year-old at home. I've got a marriage that I would like to contribute to meaningfully.
Exactly.
So those types of things, I think, are things that, you know, we have to look at the overall burden. But I think the more hands that we have, it makes lighter work. And maybe we start leaning on things. Maybe we have someone that in our states that are really gung-ho about contributing to governmental affairs and they love government work and that, well, fantastic. Let's get them plugged in right away. But, you know, when we have so many people and so many moving cogs, people can sometimes get lost in the system or they lose interest. And so it's pretty challenging.
Yeah. And, you know, we have a pretty good conglomerate of ATs in our state where, you know, we really had to step up the reimbursement for their services. And I think that's a big one because, it's going to vary state to state, obviously, and district to district. But we don't come in under $50 an hour. I mean, we just come in set $50. This is what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Some may demand more. But, you know, the way I kind of put it to our AD, I said, listen, you know, you're paying referees how much to referee a game, right? You have a medical professional. You're trying to make sure that all of the athletes on the field on both sidelines are safe. So the $50 an hour to you is an insurance policy, but it's also you're getting quality candidates to be able to do the job.
Absolutely.
So if we have a conflict of interest and we need to cover two high impact games or high rate of injury games, we need somebody there. But then we go back and say, well, athletic training just isn't about coverage because coverage could be EMT coverage, right? So I think there's that conversation there about we have to maybe educate better on what athletic trainers do. We don't just cover games.
Right.
We provide pre-game preparations, in-game, post-game, if we're working with those athletes and making sure that that's the message. Because when you say coverage, they can say, well, why don't we just hire an EMT? And then you have to have the conversation about what there's a practice act on. They can't return to play and they have no jurisdiction on diagnosing. They can assess, but then they'll emergently send them to the ED. But I think that's where some of the conversation or language may need to change, but I'm not certain in other states on how that's going.
Yeah. And I think there's probably from legality, there's probably a precedent that exists for calling things coverage, but I'm blanking on his last name. I think it's Tory Lindsay, who is our president of the NATA a few years back. I remember one of his keynote speeches at NATA. I forget where I was at, but he was stressing the importance of when we are in conversation with people about what we do, we don't necessarily provide coverage. We are providing care. So when I am overseeing a competition or a practice, that is healthcare. Mm-hmm. When I am taping a joint, that is healthcare. When I am stretching or when I'm treating or applying manual therapy or modalities, that is all healthcare. And I think that there's some importance in us using the phrases that are common amongst healthcare. That way, we're putting ourselves at least in verbiage or word on the same playing field as other healthcare professionals, where maybe it starts to switch. And it's a passive way of advocating for our profession, but it is a way to advocate for a profession.
Yeah, I couldn't agree anymore. I think there's got to be the language change, I think, and that goes back to our profession, right? You know, are we called athletic trainers, athletic therapists, sports medicine professionals?
Right, right.
I think there's that whole conversation. We could probably take days to discuss that, but I guess that kind of rolls us into the DAT programs.
Yeah.
There's, you know, obviously advanced degrees, and it makes us better with whatever we do to advance our degrees, our education. Do you think it's a necessity that we need to start looking towards it? I know it's a big topic of debate, and some argue that the programs are elevating the profession, but at some level close to physical therapy or on the same level as PT, and others question why, if it's essential or not. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, you know, I think the DAT programs and that pathway is definitely serving a purpose. Now, I have to acknowledge that my own bias is
you went through one.
DAT. I contributed and taught in a DAT, and I was a director of a DAT program before, right? But because of that, I had a very unique perspective into the profession. And so you said it perfectly from what, you know, Dr. Starkey had mentioned was, you know, ATs that pass the BOC exam, ATs that graduate from their accredited programs, and then pass the BOC, I'll say that in that way, and then gain their licensure or registration, whatever it is. They are viewed as the entry level. That is the barrier we've got to get to enter the profession.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of skills. And if you look at the curriculum that the KD is, you know, kind of laying out for each program, there's a lot of things, right? And so when we're squeezing programs into 2 years, because that's probably all we can have students for, we can make a 3, 4, 5 year program, but then is that student going to want to go to that program, or are they going to go somewhere 2 years and less money, right? But there's so much content that it's hard to be an expert or an advanced practitioner in all of that.
Right.
And so that's where I see DAT programs stepping in and filling the void of creating a bridge between entry-level practice and then developing advanced practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the critical component that we have, is that is not to make a slight at anyone who's not had an advanced degree. That is not what I intend to say. Rather than we're creating an incubator for advanced thought, advanced practice, advanced research on things that are relevant to AT.
Yeah. And I think that's a great explanation for people that don't understand why that was developed and why it's an important piece to advance a career. I always say education is never wasted. And if I had enough, you know, brain cells left in my brain, I'd probably try to do it, but I'm too old.
Yeah.
I feel like I didn't need to go get my DAT. I have 2 advanced degrees. So for me, I'm like, I don't think I need to. If it was around 15 years ago, maybe, or if I did it right at the beginning, maybe, but.
Yeah. And you can look at the spectrum of DATs, you know, each of them, I think, kind of have their own unique spin on what they think advanced practice should look like or what it is. You know, I will speak for Idaho because I'm most familiar with that. But, you know, you look at their focus, they are very manual therapy, hands-on, direct mentorship in real time. Those things that I think are a part of clinical practice for athletic trainers. Now, I would say it's most important because we're hands-on patients most of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you look at other programs, they have other clear focuses or foci that yield to other phases of AT practice, whether it's data and informatics or whether it is kind of a perspective of entrepreneurship. Like, all of these things are important to the profession. So rather than, you know, students saying, I want to get my DAT, I'll say, well, what do you want to do with that? And that will dictate what type of degree and where you go.
Right, right.
Or even if you should get a degree, maybe there's a Con Ed course that you could spend far less money on to get that skill set, and then you focus and hone in that skill set.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of mapped out for me, I wanted to get into a leadership role, and I love clinical excellence. So for me, being more clinical and working analytically on things to be able to get to where I want to get from my athletes and patients. So for me, that's how I mapped out my kind of way of creating a better education for myself. So absolutely. I think if you do that, you put a timeline and try to map it out. What's important? What do I want to get out of this? What do I want to do professionally? That will give you the idea.
Absolutely.
I don't love research, but I'll do it. So for me, like that would be the most difficult part for me, even though I would sit down and do it. It's not my first like love. I think clinically doing clinical hands-on for me is what I like to do the best.
Absolutely. And entering the DAT, I would have been the first to say research, doing research, reading research didn't excite me at all. But because of the mentorship that I received while I was working my doctorate, that's where I realized like, oh, we can have a deeper and more intentional type of learning. And maybe that spurs advances in my own practice or in the practice of all athletic trainers. If I discover something that works phenomenally well, I think that there should be a burden on us, regardless of our degree or our education, to share that with others. And so that's where I see that is it kind of this incubator of, you know, we're creating the pathways to realize, ooh, research and practice is actually probably far more feasible than what I thought it was prior to me starting the program.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. So your role at UK, I mean, this is your first year. What you've seen so far, where do you think the future of that program is going? How are you guys going to expand? Is that...
Yeah.
Something that you're going to, you know, are you guys talking about that as a faculty in the profession of athletic training, but also elsewhere, like you do a little bit with some of the nutrition programs?
Yeah.
What else is there that you see on the horizon?
Yeah. So our department here is the athletic training program. And then also we have clinical nutrition in our program. Admittedly, I don't work with the clinical nutrition as much, but as far as the AT, you know, we have a unique standing in the profession. We have some, I mean, truly excellent faculty here in research roles and then also in teaching roles that get to invest and pour into our students. When you have double digit faculty that are able to teach across our curriculum, and that's just AT, that doesn't reference other affiliate faculty that we have in other departments here or that they come in and help teach. And we're pulling in content experts and we have people that are making change for the profession through research. A lot of the work that's happening in our Sports Med Research Institute here is focused at our tactical athletes, you know, fire and EMS. And, you know, those are the things that we are, you know, I don't know that they're emerging anymore. They're very much here, but we're influencing change for those groups and we're creating kind of these outward facing changes for the profession, which is awesome. And so, you know, the program itself, you know, we have a unique history as a post-professional education program pathway. You know, Kentucky has a very storied past and a lot of awesome alumni in that post-professional pathway. But on the other side of that, I think that, you know, we have a unique pathway here that, you know, when the professional master's was created a few years ago, that we get to tap into our incredible resources here at the university. We get to tap into our awesome alumni work and the work that's been accomplished by awesome students, alumni, and faculty in the past, and then kind of pioneer our new pathway. You know, I think whether we look at it from a national perspective, a regional, a state perspective, you know, the demand for healthcare for athletic trainers is, I think, only going to increase. You know, I've kind of debated, you know, would we consider athletic trainers as a mid-level provider? And I think there's things that can challenge that. But regardless, can we become the content experts in the intermediary in the healthcare system? And I think that we see our program fulfilling that need for the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And then for our students that are going off into other positions, that they're able to take this education that they've gotten here and apply that to wherever they're going. And so it's a unique perspective where we have this young program at a university that has, I don't say infinite resources, but, you know, there's just so access to so much here. And it's continuing to grow where we have, you know, a new building being built that's going to house our AT programs and new simulation spaces. And it truly is something where I feel like we're in a petri dish of, you know, how can we prepare not only current students, but also how can we impact the profession as a whole? And we challenge our students to do a lot. You know, we value service here. We value contribution to things just beyond our own education. And that is for students and faculty alike. So we require our students to get service hours for their community, for the program, for the profession. And that same standard is carried over to our faculty as well. And those are things that we track and assess annually for ourselves, which is a pretty cool thing.
I think you guys are doing a great job and hopefully you can keep doing it because it's going to help and it's going to speak volumes for the profession, especially if you're providing a lot of those other avenues for what athletic trainers can do. And I mean, you know, it's awesome that you guys are doing it, continue to do it. I think it's a service that you, you know, obviously love providing, and hopefully right. it keeps growing. The faculty keeps growing and the
yeah.
and the students keep growing. Jumping back real quick to the NATA, I reached out yeah. to them about a month ago to try to, I want to bring the podcast to NATA, and no one got back to me.
Okay.
So if you know anybody.
I might actually.
Tell them to get in touch with me because yes. I'd love to go down and do some live sessions and speak Absolutely. To athlete trainers. I mean, we're yeah. trying to promote the profession and let people understand what the profession is, what we do, how we do it, how we're making athletes better
yeah.
in our service that we're providing. And, you know, I'd love to be able to come down there and do that. It's just getting into the right person to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would love to see if we can help that happen for you.
That'd be great. Listen, Matt. Thanks. I appreciate your time today. I think the conversation was great. Hopefully yeah. this resonates with a lot of our colleagues and peers and the people that aren't in our profession get to learn a little bit more about athlete training. So I do appreciate Absolutely. Your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad we were able to chat today.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
All right.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we're committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned for our next episode.